Take a look at the two extremes generally offered about the future. Either it's a gleaming utopia populated by healthy people, or it's a barren landscape of scruffy tribes barely eking out a living. Do you embrace one of those or fall somewhere in the middle? We'll place today's guest, at least at first, on the gleaming utopia end. Robert Bryce expresses confidence in people and technology to solve many of the problems we've created. His book lists the attributes we've already brought to bear: smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. Subtitle: How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. Robert Bryce is a widely published journalist and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He lives in Texas and joined us 4 years ago to talk about his previous book, Power Hungry: The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. Robert Bryce, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Fair to say, between this book and Power Hungry, you are not a guy to run with the pack, necessarily.
Well, I'd like to think that that's a fair assessment. Yes, I mean, you know, I'm not an ideologue. I don't belong to the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. I'm a member of the Disgusted Party. But what I really tried to do in Smaller, Faster, and Power Hungry, in my prior book, Gusher of Lies, was look at the math and physics, and let's look at what is happening, particularly in the energy business, because that's what I focus on a lot. But what this book tries to do beyond that is look more broadly at innovation and show why we have reason to be hopeful for the future, because we can look back and see all the innovations that have happened in everything from printing to miniaturization to computers, all of these things that have allowed us now to dramatically increase our standards of living all over the world. The poorest of the poor are gaining wealth all over the world. People are living longer, healthier, happier lives than at any time in human history, and yet we're inundated with a lot of bad news. So I wrote the book to try and point out some of these positive trends.
You know, I was trying to figure out, though, does this make you an optimist or does it make you an anti-pessimist? There is a difference, isn't there?
That's a great question. I think it's an anti-pessimist. I'm not Dr. Pangloss here. As I point out in the book, innovation gave us penicillin and also gave us the AK-47. I mean, we're creating a lot of problems as we go along, and we're perfecting, in many cases, a lot of technologies that can kill vast numbers of people. So I'm not a utopian. I'm optimistic, but I guess I think that's more correct. I'm an anti-pessimist.
All right, we'll take it at that. And you mentioned just now that you're not a member of you're not a Democrat or Republican, but a member of the Disgusted Party. You dislike, as you point out in the book, the left-right polarity. You do say you like smart people who believe in economic growth and liberty, which I guess would put you somewhere in the libertarian end of the things, wouldn't it?
Oh, I suppose, and that's okay with me. But I think that we always have the tension, Jeffrey, between the market and government, and that tension is going to continue. And I'm not an anti-government sort. We need government to foster regulation. We need regulation. We need fair markets. We need, but in addition, we also need a situation where we don't hamper entrepreneurs and businesses to the point where they can't innovate, where they can't hire more people, because that's where the U.S., I think, has been particularly strong in the last few decades, and I believe will continue being strong, is our ability to innovate, iterate, and to create economic growth based on new ideas and new capital formation.
You know, when we typed the word catastrophist on our stuff here, we ended up getting a warning that it was not part of the dictionary. Is this a word you made up?
No, I thought that word was, since the book has been published and I see how many people mispronounce it, I realize, well, it's not an overly common word, but, you know, it's I just did it myself. I just looked it up, and it's on dictionary.com, free dictionary, urban dictionary. I mean, it's not a word I made up.
All right, so are the catastrophists like Chicken Little? Is this what you see going on in the world today with what you call collapse anxiety?
Well, you know, I think the collapse anxiety, and what I try and do in the book is point out how much this view of the future, of poisoned earth, is very typical of what we hear from mainstream environmentalism, that we have to quit using energy, particularly modern forms of energy. We have to quit using hydrocarbons, otherwise we're faced with ruination. I think that catastrophist message is particularly potent and is particularly present in a lot of the mainstream green groups, and that's another reason why I was motivated to write the book.
Well, all right. So let's talk about some of the things that people see as problems coming up. I mean, certainly population, environmental degradation, and help out the people who hear the term Malthusian and get confused. Who was Malthus and what did he write?
Malthus was a Brit, and in the late 1700s, he predicted that the world was going to run out of food. We were going to face starvation on a mass scale because the population of the planet was growing faster than the ability of farmers to produce food. And that attitude has been embodied now in a number of people since then. It also, I kind of twin it a little bit with the view that was put forward by Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the late 1700s, not about the same time of Malthus, where he said we need to go back to the land. You know, he brought up this idea of the noble savage, that we need to return to nature. So this idea of Malthusian outlook and this Rousseauian outlook, I think, are two dominant themes in modern environmentalism.
Just the idea that we're going to end up using up what we got and we're going to have to scale back.
Exactly.
Robert Bryce is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. You'll probably hear him refer to it as Smaller, Faster, just for abbreviation purposes. We'll come back and talk with him about his vision of the future and how it compares with yours. If you'd like to join us on the Exchange, come back to the Exchange with Robert Bryce and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and futurist, I guess you could call him too, Robert Bryce, the author of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, an idea that technology can solve many of the problems we have created in the world today. Join us on the Exchange with your thoughts as we go through the conversation, 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Robert, there are several sets of toes you step on in the book by name. Richard Heinberg, one of them. He's been a guest several times. You take him on for his approach to, well, peak everything is one of the books you really pick on. You don't believe that we've reached peak oil yet, or do you? Or is you just not as concerned about reaching peak anything?
I think it's the latter, that I'm not as concerned about peak anything, peak copper, peak oil, peak gas, whatever. The reality is that the idea that we're running out of something ignores the influence or the incredibly powerful combination of price and technology. So we have already had here in the United States effectively peak oil demand. Even though our population continues rising, why is our oil demand peaked here in the United States? Well, because we're driving less. My children don't drive as much as I did when I was their age. Our cars have gotten more efficient. Our population has aged. We're also facing peak electricity usage here in the United States. For decades, we had electric demand that was growing rapidly, 10% or more per decade. Now, it's effectively flat. Why? Even despite, again, population increases, we're using electricity more expensive. We're using electricity more efficiently. So this idea that we're going to run out of something, well, okay, granted, fine, but we're continually figuring out ways to use it more efficiently by making things smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper.
You start your examples in the book with the Panama Canal. What do we learn about smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper through that process?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the Panama Canal, and I've seen it a couple times now, most recently just a year ago or a year ago next month now. To me, it is the most obvious example on the planet of this quest for faster, cheaper. For 400 years now, humans have been talking about building a canal or some way across the Isthmus of Panama in order to shorten the distance from the Atlantic to the Pacific and back. And it's such a magnificent example of engineering and ingenuity and this desire to decrease the amount of time and money that it takes to transport goods and people from the east coast of the U.S. to the west coast, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And it also coincides, by the way, with the 100-year the publishing of the book in 2014 is the 100th year anniversary of the opening of the canal. So to me, it was just the set of circumstances were just perfect in terms of why that serves as a great example.
You do give other examples of the ways in which technology can be a real two-edged sword. I mean, workers are always getting they're tired of hearing at this point in history about do more with less, but examples abound where you can get much more efficient use of people and resources with things like the vacuum tube. And one of the examples you give is with a couple of electrified guitars, you can create a whole orchestra behind somebody where you needed a lot more musicians beforehand. But then you already gave the example of the AK-47. We need not discuss exactly what makes that so efficient, but it certainly does a lot more with a lot less.
Absolutely. And I think the musical example you cite is one. I'm pleased that you brought it up. It's fascinating, and I've cited a couple of books and other things that have been done about what undermined the Soviet Union. Now, Reagan could say, well, it was Star Wars and the build-up of the American defense machine. All of these things played a factor. There's no one reason why the Iron Curtain fell, but there is credible evidence to point out that the rise of rock and roll, which is directly due to the advent of the vacuum tube and low-cost electric guitars and low-cost amplifiers, that now rock and roll became something young people loved, and it was banned by the authorities in the Soviet Union, and the young people said, well, this is what we like. You're out of touch. And that was part of the undermining of the whole system, but it was because of low-cost amplification, of cheaper materials, and the ability to a free expression became one of these drivers of really huge social change.
Again, the book is called Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. Robert Bryce, the author here on the Jefferson Exchange. You talk about, at this point in history, never have so many lived so well. I mean, the opportunities for us to be healthy if we choose to keep ourselves in good shape are abundant. But at the same time, we have things like the superbugs, the things that are resisting technologies of anti- What are we talking about? Antibiotics. Are we hitting limits then? I mean, it seems like we're going to have to really rethink what we've done to be able to make that next technological leap that you're always fairly confident we'll make.
Well, of course. But think back just, 70 years ago, we didn't have antibiotics. We didn't have any of them. So if you had an infection, you were either going to stay very sick for a very long time or you were going to die. So I think I take your point, and it's clear that we have now antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria and other things. There's no question about that. But as we create better tools, the challenges that we have to deal with are obvious. We create new challenges as we go along. But, I mean, to your point about living standards, over the last 40 years, the number of countries that are considered free has nearly doubled. Literacy rates. In 1950, about half of the adult population globally was literate. Today, it's close to 90%. A century ago, very few women anywhere had the right to vote. Today, in nearly every country in the world, Saudi Arabia, a few others being the obvious exceptions, women are allowed to vote. In 2012, in the Summer Olympics, for the first time, all of the countries participating in the games included women on their teams, and they were competing. I mean, we've seen a revolution, really, even in the last 100 years, just in the rights of women and girls.
Which begs the question, then, about which parts of the world are the ones that often comment on the more pessimistic view of the future? Because when you think about the fact that we live in a society where the standard of living has gotten good and stayed there for a very long time, there is obviously the propensity to think about, well, gee, maybe we're going to see a decline in our standards of living, versus the places you just cited where living situations have improved on many levels, where people can look more optimistically at the future, because they've gotten a lot better in the recent history.
No question about it. And you mentioned collapse anxiety before, and that's a term that was coined, I believe, by Greg Easterbrook. And I think it's part of where we are as a society today in the West. And we live in the wealthy West, and we can afford, frankly, this kind of attitude of feeling bad about how good we have it. I mean, that we have the luxury of being feeling guilty. And I don't mean that to be flip, but there's truth in this idea that, let's compare our standards of living today, where we have easy access to electricity, to motor fuel, all of these other things, and think about India alone having 400 million people without access to electricity. I mean, it's a stunning number. So would you trade places with that person? I sure would not. But there's this, now that we live in abundance, is that we have the ability that, well, maybe we just have it too good, and of course things are going to fall apart, and so on.
Wow, that's about 40% of the population with no access to electricity.
40% of India, that's
yeah,
right.
India,
roughly. And it's a stunning number. And it also goes to one of the points where, you know, the double-edged sword that I point out in the book. What is India doing to try and bring more electricity availability? It's burning coal, and lots of it.
Let us talk more about that with Robert Bryce. The book is Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. And it is the subtitle is How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. That's anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Bryce.
Hi, well, you got my attention, and I wish there was all these technological answers to our environmental problems, but unfortunately, the scientists are in total disagreement with you, and unfortunately, you're not really an expert, because I've been following the science for 18 years, and every climate report, every year, the scientists say global warming is accelerating at a faster pace, and it's a dire situation. So as much as I wish that you were right, I don't think science backs you up. In 2001, there was one climate change feedback loop, and today there's 30. And according to Guy McPherson, who's a climatologist who's on the very opposite end of your belief system, he believes it's already too late for humanity, and we got about 16 years before most of life is wiped out as all these problems intensify. We have acidification of the ocean. We have peak soil, water shortages. Just today in the paper, California's drought is diminishing the hydroelectric dams, which are a cleaner form of energy. So as much as, you know, you're painting a really pretty picture, you aren't backing it up with any facts. So that's my question is, where's your facts that we're going to avert this disaster? Because the scientists are not on your side. Maybe a couple that work for the fossil fuel industry.
All right, let's pick it up from there.
I'll listen on the radio. Thanks
for the call. Appreciate it. Well, you had to expect a call like
asking,
that.
You're asking for facts, and you've given me predictions. There's a difference. Look, I understand what the climate discussion, and I read both sides of the climate arguments about we're facing imminent ruin or CO2 isn't a problem. I'm a resolute agnostic. Tell me CO2 is good. Tell me it's bad. I'm bored with the tribalism. The reality is that CO2 emissions are rising, and they're rising rapidly by more than 500 million tons a year. So you can give me a prediction and call it a fact that scientists agree, some of them do, on that we're facing climate ruination. You can ask another group of scientists who you throw out that I don't agree with the scientists. Well, okay, fine. The issue facing us on the climate, and you're bringing one issue as being the deciding one when we have a public health, we have sanitation, we have transportation, we have all these other issues that we have to deal with. But when it comes to climate, my response to you is we're simply going to have to adapt, whether it gets hotter, whether we have more extreme weather, whether it gets colder. And I also say that if we're going to be serious about climate, we need to use natural gas and nuclear. Those are the best options, best no-regrets policy going forward. So, you know, you've asked for facts when you've just spouted a lot of predictions. Well, I can make a lot of predictions, too, but I think the thesis of the book is look at all the progress we've made. Why would we think we're going to stop progress now in dealing with the challenges we face? We're not.
All right, so you tend to look at where we have come already, the things that have already been invented, but do you cast that ahead at all and look at things like tech? I mean, lots of stuff has been written already about, hey, you know, we could do this, that, or the other thing to potentially retard the growth of carbon in the atmosphere or walk it backwards. Is there anything that looks promising to you on what you've seen out there?
In terms of CO2 specifically and energy?
Yes, yes.
Well, look at all the money that has happened or that is flowing into the nuclear generation sector. I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. Now, is nuclear going to make a step change and we're going to see huge numbers of gigawatts of new deployments of nuclear generation in the next few years? No, we're not. But look at how the interest in nuclear has risen even in the wake of Fukushima, so that you have Nathan Myhrvold and Bill Gates backing a company called TerraPower, looking at new reactor models. Look at a company called Transatomic that is developing a new reactor with a molten salt design. We're seeing all kinds of innovation in the energy sector that's been very positive. The most obvious example of that is here in the United States in the oil and gas industry, how we're now producing record quantities of natural gas thanks to innovation in the oil and gas sector, which is another thing that I write about in the book, which is allowing us to have lower cost energy and therefore improving our economy and attracting not billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in foreign capital.
Well, you know, when we talk about the fossil fuels, it brings us back to your earlier book, Power Hungry, and density was a big part of your argument there. So explain the concept of power density in petroleum versus other fuels.
Well, sure. Thank you. And I can talk about aerial power density, and I will, but just broadly on what is power density. Power density is a measure of energy flow that can be harnessed in a given area, volume, or mass. So we have different types of power density. Power density is just a common metric in physics. And I'll preface it, Jeffrey, by just pointing out power density in a car engine. I'm fascinated by Ford Motor Company, and it's smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. I have a chapter on Ford, and I talk about their new EcoBoost engine. It's a 1 liter turbocharged three-cylinder engine that produces 123 horsepower. It's a marvel of technology. It produces 92,000 watts per liter of displacement. That's roughly the same power density as the engine that's in the Bugatti Veyron, a car that costs $1.2 million. So we're seeing increasing power density both on the energy consumption side, on the conversion of energy in our engines and our light bulbs and so on. We're seeing higher power densities there. But one of the reasons why I'm so opposed to wind energy and biofuels in particular is their low power density. They require a lot of land. They produce very few watts per square meter of land required. So, as I show in the book, the power density of wind energy is 1 watt per square meter. Period. End of story. Well, if we're going to replace coal-fired electricity in the United States with wind energy, we need a land area then roughly the size of Italy. I mean, this is basic math and basic physics. Nothing I'm making up. But that's why power density matters. We want to be able to produce energy from very small footprints, and we want to be able to consume it with very small devices because they have high power density, and they're smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper.
Which is the name of the book, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. Robert Bryce, the author, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Here's John in Grants Pass. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi. It's refreshing to hear someone who puts things in perspective. And so I guess your guest could kind of rephrase that, but I'll give you an example. Your previous caller was, to me, sounded like the classic doomsdayer. And don't get me wrong, I consider myself to be a liberal and an environmentalist, but maybe, I guess my question would be, what is the difference between reasonable people, environmentalists, and these doomsdayers who apparently this woman thought the world's going to end in about 10 years? And That's rather doomsday, if you mean. And let me give you one more quick example. I grew up in Portland, and when we took Dad's boat out on the Willamette River back in the 60s, the river was, the cities up and down the line were dumping raw sewage in there. Nowadays, the river is incredibly clean. In fact, there was so much debris in the water, we almost sank because we ran over a power pole. Anyway, thanks. There's positive things to look at, and I wish everybody, I just have a hard time with the doomsdayers.
All right, thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Whoop, you had more there. Go ahead, John.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, I couldn't have said it better than the caller. I mean, I think he just makes a great point, and I think the prior caller had that same outlook that we're just inundated with this bad news. Well, the world, we have 16 years, and then it's all over. Well, are you sure it's not 15? Are you sure not 17? I mean, look, we are just inundated with these predictions of imminent peril, and yes, California is facing water shortages. Well, we may have to use desalination. We may be facing the same challenges here in Texas where the drought is ongoing. We're not going to sit around and freeze in the dark. We're going to do what we have to innovate, to continue building our economy and employing people.
When you talk about the response to Pam earlier, that call that now we're talking about again, you know, we're just going to have to figure out how to live in places where it's warmer. I mean, do you see humans beginning to migrate away from the hotter parts of the earth?
You know, Jeffrey, I can't predict that. You know, I was laughing. I had a phone call this morning. I was talking to a fellow who was in Missouri, and he said the high the other day there was 75. Okay, we've been told over and over we're facing climate change, and maybe this is global weirding, as Thomas Friedman from the New York Times decided. Well, in Chicago, the low at night the other day, just in mid July, was in the 40s. So I'm just, I take all this certainty about climate change with a grain of salt. Is it, may we face a situation where people are going to have to migrate? Yes, perhaps. But, you know, I can't predict that. If I could, I'd own your radio station and a whole bunch of others, and I'd be a rich guy.
All right. We'll talk more with Robert Bryce about his book, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. We'll talk more about the catastrophists and their points of view and take some calls from you as well here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Robert Bryce and your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Robert Bryce, longtime journalist, published in many places, author of several books. His latest is called Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about a future in which Robert Bryce sees that our advances in technology continue to solve many of the problems we've created. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We could clearly spend the whole hour talking about climate change. I just want to ask the question one way that it has been posed elsewhere, which is, if we address climate change as if it's a huge problem, the worst thing that happens is we get a cleaner planet. I mean, what's the approach that you recommend, regardless of what you believe about, what anybody believes, I mean, about climate change?
Sure. Well, I'm just writing, in fact, a long paper. I have a chapter in the book about coal, and I'm working on a longish paper about what's happening in the coal market. One thing we need to do and do right away is encourage more efficient coal combustion. Coal is not going away. In China, India, the rest of the developing world, Pakistan, Indonesia, they're building coal plants at a tremendous rate. So we need to make certain as they build them, they're using the best technology instead of subcritical technology, using supercritical and ultra-supercritical technology, so they get more electricity out of each kilogram of coal that they burn. Second, I think we need to be using more natural gas and more nuclear. Those are technologies that, as you say, are good for the environment. They result in lower air pollutants, and so I think these are positive. I'm bullish on solar. I'm not bullish on wind. I'm not bullish on biofuels. Solar, we're going to see rapid growth in solar, but remember, solar is starting from a very small base. And I'll just give you one quick comparison, Jeffrey. In the last 12 months alone, U.S. oil production has increased by about 1.2 million barrels per day. Just the increase in domestic oil production in the U.S. is equal to twice the contribution of all global solar. So we can be bullish on solar, and I am, but we have to remember how small it is, the base that solar is starting from.
Let's take some more calls. Let's go to Tom in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Bryce.
Well, good morning. I appreciate his attitude about, smaller, faster, more efficient and everything. But I have a question about his logic with wind, and I understand the the technical specifications, but he's talking about, he's optimistic about, we can improve the, internal combustion engine, we can improve the efficiency and the cleanliness of the coal process. Why are you so wedded to the fact that wind will only produce so many watts per square meter or whatever it was you said? Why are you completely wedded to that and you say end of story? Whereas you have a different attitude towards the other technologies.
All right. Thanks for that question, Tom. Appreciate it. Robert?
Well, basic physics. Again, you cannot increase the power density of the wind. The constraint is the amount of energy, kinetic energy, that is contained in the wind. Can you make your wind turbines bigger? Yes, you can. Can you make them taller? Of course. And we have. But they're faced with this fundamental constraint about the amount of energy that's available that they can convert into electricity. You can't change that. So, yes, we're going to have more efficient conversion devices, but, this power density constraint of 1 watt per square meter, and I go into chapter and verse on it in my book, is the fundamental constraint. And second, so we have this constraint. Well, what does it mean? It means more land use. And what do we see then when we have this land use, this energy sprawl with wind? You have backlash. And I can point you to dozens of examples all over the world of this backlash against the encroachment of wind energy. It was about a year ago, 4,000 people marched in Dublin opposing wind energy in Ireland. I mean, this is, you know, we don't hear about it in the mainstream press in the United States, but the backlash against the sprawl of the wind energy business is real, and it is growing.
Let's take another one. Here is Art in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Bryce. Art, go ahead.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Mr. Bryce criticizes the quote-unquote catastrophists for basing their arguments on predictions, but it seems like that's what his whole book is about. Predictions that technology is going to save the infinite growth fantasy of capitalism. So that kind of criticism makes it seem like this book is about propaganda, which would also be suggested by his association with the Manhattan Institute. That's my comment. Thank you.
I'm so pleased you brought that up. Thank you.
All right. So tell us about the Manhattan Institute. Robert?
Is the caller gone?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Well, so, you know, I love it when people bring this up because it's indicative to me of how shallow their arguments are. I've been writing the same things for years. In fact, before I joined the Manhattan Institute, I wrote Power Hungry. They read Power Hungry and said, this is, you know, we like what you've written here. Join us. So somehow there's this allegation that because the Manhattan Institute takes a small bit of their funding from companies that they don't like or from the oil and gas or the energy business, that somehow anything that Manhattan Institute puts out is therefore compromised. You know, it's laughable because they don't come to any of the table with any math, any physics, or any facts, and so they devolve into name-calling and, oh, well, he's affiliated with them, therefore we can't trust anything he says. Well, you know, I love to hear this argument because it's so shallow. But, you know, the other point the caller made, oh, it's propaganda. I'm looking at, in the book, I don't make any predictions about what might happen, but I make clear, if we look at what is happening now, both in our energy conversion devices, in medicine, I talk about a company called the Scanadu Scout and their ability to get blood pressure information, respiration rates, heartbeat, all these things in just a few seconds with a device that will then feed that information digitally to your phone. We're seeing all this innovation happening on all these different sectors. So why do we think we're suddenly going to stop? This innovation will continue.
You know, I probably unfairly called you a futurist a bit ago. You're more like a presentist. You figure out the things that have happened up until this moment. And you're not much of an extrapolator. That is fair to say, I would think.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, that corn is going to grow to the moon. And I'm not saying that that oil production is going to continue rising forever. It's not. We're constrained by our infrastructure, by a lot of things, by available land. So I'm not making a call that, you know, suddenly we're all going to sit around the campfire and sing Kumbaya. It's not going to happen. Look at what's happening in Damascus and in Gaza and in Afghanistan. We're seeing violence all over the world. But to claim that we're all headed for ruination is equally wrong.
But I want to come back to the point made by Art in Klamath Falls, though. I mean, because he made a reference to consistent economic growth. You have mentioned quite often that you are for economic growth.
Sure.
But there are also finite resources. I mean, even if we're able to reduce the population on the planet over time, and I'm not talking through anything other than through managing birth rates, we still have finite resources. It's the one planet we get.
There's no question. And why am I for economic growth? Because that allows more people to have jobs and to lead productive lives. And so, yes, I'm unapologetic about that. But we're getting more and more economic growth out of fewer and fewer inputs. We're using today our economy, I don't know where we're more than three times, I believe, the economy we had in 1973 here in the United States. We're burning just a fraction more oil today than we were back then. We're getting more output out of lower inputs. So I'm unapologetic about my desire for economic growth because that means employment, that means jobs, that means people live more fulfilling lives. And so one of the points that I make in the book is I'm adamantly opposed to this crowd that isn't for degrowth. And the World Watch Institute has said we're in favor of degrowth. Bill McKibben with 350.org has said we need our economic systems are too big, we need to start building them back down. What does that mean? You're for in favor of mass unemployment? I am not in favor of mass unemployment. I'm in favor of people having jobs and being productive.
If we're talking about doing more with less, though, we can come back as far as the 20s, wasn't it? When John Kenneth Galbraith talked about the fact that we have, you know, we're getting so efficient with the things we do, nobody really needs to work a full week anymore. And yet here we are, it seems like working even more hours.
Well, you know, and you make a good point. And in Europe and France in particular, where they cut the work week to 34 hours or something like that because they have an excess of workers and, you know, not enough positions to fill, not enough positions. So, again, this is one of the tensions that happens when we change, when we innovate. I make reference in the book to the Luddites who smashed the mechanical looms because they thought they were going to be out of work. We create economic dislocations as we change, as we innovate, as we create new systems. There's no question about it. But to think that we can stand still and not move forward, I think is a perilous proposition.
Let's take another call. We have Jacob in Springfield on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Bryce, the author of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper.
Hi, Mr. Bryce. I also wanted to add, you left out one word in your title, and it's simpler, and I would like very much to have a future that is more simple. I think that actually is something that we should yearn for, you know, something that's a virtue. Now, I wanted to point out the unintended effects of technology and how some things that people, you know, underestimate can actually change the world in big ways. We've been fighting the war on terror for over a decade, since 9/11, and nothing's really improved it, whether, you know, hearts and minds, or sending armies or equipping Middle East armies. But the one thing that has made effect that very few people have linked to you know, a better relationship of America with the Arab world is fracking. By having fracking, America has actually had more of an independent energy supply, and they're not dependent on, or they're not hostage to Arab influences and Arab policies and backing up bad regimes, and we actually have more diplomatic independence because we have more energy independence, and that therefore we could stay out of, you know, the next Iraq war. We could stay out of Libya. We could stay out of Syria. Okay. And now, one more thing is, for instance, mobile technology and social media networking. Young people are very much into this. They're on it, you know, all waking hours of the day texting or whatever. But what happens is it's actually influenced them in terms of their travel. They don't see the need to travel and to use a car and to have a car or to actually go to different places of the world because they actually are connected. You know, they could be national, they could be in New York, or they could be international, but they're just social networking. Their world is wider, it's more global, but at the same time,
sure,
they don't need to spend oil traveling there.
Right.
So they don't own cars.
You make a lot of points, sir, and they're interesting ones. I think, you know, you make the point about hydraulic fracturing. It's look, we live in an interdependent world. I've written a book on the fallacy of energy independence. We live in an interdependent world, but that all of that said, think of where the U.S. would be today if without the shale gale, without the development of hydraulic fracturing and extended reach horizontal drilling, we would be looking to Russia for natural gas supplies. We would be dramatically constrained in terms of our oil availability. I can't predict what the price of oil today would be without this massive surge in U.S. oil and gas production, but it obviously would be far higher than where it is today, particularly given the unrest in Iraq and elsewhere. So the innovation that's happened in the upstream oil and gas sector with hydraulic fracturing has been an incredible economic boom to the United States, about 3% addition to U.S. GDP. It's remarkable.
But is technology doing enough to cover some of the problems that people see with fracking?
Well, and that's a fair question, Jeffrey, and I've been in the oil field. I've seen pollution in the oil field, and oil and gas production does take a toll. I mean, there's no free lunch when it comes to energy production. My response to your question is, yes, we're seeing, I think, very rapid iteration and innovation in the oil and gas sector, where they're working very quickly to try and reduce their footprints in terms of how many, how many well pads they have is a good example. Years ago, they'd drill one well and they'd move a couple miles or a mile or two and drill another one. Now they're drilling 3, 4, 5, even as many as 20 or even 40 wells from a single location, so that they reduce the number of roads that they build and so on. So, and when it comes to methane emissions, when it comes to water, all these things, I think the industry is clearly could do better, and they are doing better, and it's going to take time. But I'm again very bullish on that that iteration process, because there's so many billions of dollars being spent in the oil and gas sector now, $300 billion or more alone just here in the United States, just drilling oil wells.
Now, you say in the book, too, that you think the U.S. will own the smaller, faster future. But given our current status in the world, which seems to be slipping in math and science skills, I mean, how do you see that coming together?
You know, I hear that, you know, that we're slipping in math and science skills, and perhaps that's true. But where the U.S. leads is in availability of low-cost resources, energy in particular. I mentioned the amount of money that's being now flowing to the U.S., the Egyptians, the Pakistanis, the Germans, South Africa. The South African company Sasol alone is spending $21 billion on a new gas-to-liquids plant here in the United States. All this foreign capital is coming here for a reason. Why? We have trusted capital markets. We have a good regulatory regime. We have the best land-grant colleges and university systems in the world. We have 5% of the world's population. We have about 40% of the Nobel laureates have been Americans or living in America. So you combine all those things with this entrepreneurial spirit that exists in the U.S. in spades, and I'm incredibly bullish on the U.S.
All right. It's always a provocative chat when we have Robert Bryce on. The latest book is called Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophist Wrong. Robert, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks a million, Jeffrey.
Take care. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the lawsuits about the bull trout, trying to get protection for the bull trout in parts of the West. 8:30, we'll talk about recycling fluorescent lights and the new issues that they present. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of the book, A Mind for Numbers. Her assurance is that, yes, we can all do math. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.